What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Itamar Rabinovich. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I don't know if you've been following the Occupy Wall Street movement or not. Frankly, I haven't really been all that attentive myself. Occupy Tucson is considerably smaller and less important, I suppose, than Occupy Wall Street. And when I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico last weekend as a scholar in residence, the Occupy Santa Fe movement was, well, even smaller. To be honest, I'm not exactly sure just what the whole Occupy movement has been all about, except that it seems to have collected a mixture of social activists, the unemployed, the disillusioned, the highly idealistic, the homeless, the utopians, the young, the lost, and lots of media into a very unusual cholent. There have been some fascinating innovations. The human microphone, in which a speaker's words were shouted along by individuals so huge crowds could hear without amplification. That, by the way, is very much like an ancient Jewish institution, the Meturgaman, a guy with a really loud voice who shouted out the Torah reading in the days of the Talmud. As the Occupy Everything movement collapses and kind of disintegrates, I'm not so sure what exactly it's accomplished. Lacking solid unifying themes beyond free speech, economic and social egalitarianism, and anti-establishmentarianism. By the way, that's the first time I've ever been able to use that word in an actual spoken sentence. Anyway, the Occupy Wall Street and Everywhere Else movement, to me, is a sort of quixotic effort to change everything. Or at least, doggone it, to change something, and soon. Somehow, it also seemed kind of Jewish. Of course, there were many individual Jews, especially young ones, involved, and on Sukkot, sukkahs sprouted up amid the Occupy Wall Streeters. A former guest of Too Jewish, Daniel Saradsky, a young web guy and social organizer, has now created an organization called Occupy Judaism. Not a bad idea. Might even get more people into the shul, you know, like if they occupied it. But I'm really thinking about this in a different, less literal way. Judaism has always strongly advocated social and economic egalitarianism. You need look no further than the book of Deuteronomy and the Torah to find mitzvot, requiring redistribution of wealth and of the land in a fair and equal manner. The poor are supposed to be taken care of in our societies, and the wealthy are obligated to support them to a level not of survival, but of reasonable comfort. No one is supposed to accumulate huge amounts of money or power in the Torah. Certainly, all of this should appeal to the Occupy movementers. And we Jews have always been somewhat utopian about this troubled world. How else can you explain a people that prays in every service in the Aleinu, "Let the time not be distant when your name will be worshipped in all the earth, and error and idolatry be no more, when God will repair the world under the rule of justice and peace"? It's not like we have had many centuries when this has actually been true, right? And yet we say it in every service. Finally, in keeping with the themes of the Occupy movement, has there ever been a people more avidly dedicated to free speech than Jews? I mean, we talk all the time and argue about everything. Two Jews, three opinions, four political parties, five synagogues, and so on. And generally speaking, the occupiers were also very peaceful. Just as Jews typically are, lots of shouting, but not much violence. Anyway, may the Occupy the World types continue on in their idealistic way and spread those aspects of their message successfully. To play us in this morning, here's a beautiful section from a fantastic composition I'll be singing this afternoon with the Tucson Masterworks Chorale, Ernest Bloch's Sacred Service, one of the great works of music in the past century. Don't miss it this afternoon if you're in Tucson. It's at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel.
Amen.
That was from the Bloch Sacred Service, a gorgeous, romantic setting of the classical Reform Shabbat morning service. It'll be performed this afternoon at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Our guest this morning, former Israeli ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, is a prominent academic who knows the relationship between Israel and America as well as anyone alive. Find out what we can expect in the wake of the Arab Spring when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
On Sunday afternoon, November 20th, 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, the beautiful sacred service by Swiss-American composer Ernest Bloch will be performed by the Tucson Masterworks Chorale. This fantastic piece of music was originally commissioned by San Francisco's Temple Emmanuel, and it's one of the 20th century's finest classical works. Bloch described this passionate and romantic setting of text for the Jewish Saturday morning service as a cosmic poem, a glorification of the laws of the universe. For the Bloch Sacred Service, the Masterworks Chorale is conducted by Marcella Molina and will feature Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan as the baritone soloist. Don't miss this extraordinary performance Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson. For tickets or more information, call the Tucson Masterworks Chorale at 730-5640 or Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the Family Size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Itamar Rabinovich. He's the incumbent of the Ettinger Chair of Contemporary Middle Eastern History at Tel Aviv University. He spent an 8-year term as the university's president and, of course, was also the ambassador to the United States. He's been a member of Tel Aviv University's faculty since 1971, however, was chairman of the Department of Middle Eastern Studies and many other important positions at the university. He's the author of numerous books and academic works, 6 books on the modern history and politics of the Middle East, and the co-author and co-editor of a number of other volumes, as well as many articles. Good morning. This is an interesting time for Israel, which is to say that it's just like it always is. There seems to be some changes in Israel in response to the whole dynamic of the Arab winter, the Arab spring, the kinds of changes going on all around Israel. How would you characterize those changes right now?
You said it's always interesting in Israel, but sometimes more interesting than others. And I say it unfortunately because interesting could also be that famous Chinese curse. We now live in a particularly tumultuous period. The changes around us may carry some potential promise for the longer future, but In the shorter range, they destabilize, they create uncertainty, and they also come on top of other changes and trends that altogether add up to, I would say, a more pessimistic view of Israel's position in the Middle East as compared to a few years ago.
Israel was used to dealing with people like Mubarak. Now, of course, it's a completely different picture in Egypt. How dramatically will that really transform Israeli-Egyptian relations, in your opinion?
This still is an open question because things in Egypt are evolving. The parliamentary elections will take place, then there will be a presidential election. What we will see in Egypt, in all likelihood, would be a divided power. The military holds ultimate power, but it exercises it discreetly from behind the scenes, as far as it can do that. And it will have to share power with the elected president, with a parliament and a cabinet responsible to the parliament, and with the street. And we also expect the Muslim Brotherhood and other radical groups to do well in the elections. There are radical elements in the street. These radical elements are not favorable to Israel. They are also supportive of the Palestinian cause. There's also a bit of an anarchy in the Sinai, the area that borders on Israel. And therefore, we can expect a more difficult period in our relationship with Egypt.
You served as the chief negotiator with Syria under the late Yitzhak Rabin. Syria, do you think Syria, that Assad will fall? Do you think it's going to be like Egypt? Is he going to manage to hold on to power? What's likely to happen?
I think we are in for a long period of instability in Syria. I think that the regime is doomed, and the regime lost all legitimacy. It has now killed more than 3,000 people in the past few months, and the bulk of the population would like to see the regime go. At the same time, the regime does have the support of a coherent military and security elite of the Alawite minority community that is the backbone of the regime.
The Alawites.
Also, the middle classes of Damascus and Aleppo, the two chief cities in the country, have not joined in the rebellion. So there is a tug of war between the majority, and the regime, sort of a draw. So my bottom line is that the regime is doomed, but it will take time. It took quite a few months in Libya, despite a military intervention by NATO, and it may take much more time in Syria. So what it means for Israel is that the Syrian option that people used to discuss as an alternative to the Palestinian option in a peace process, it does not exist for now. And there are also threats, vague threats issued by the regime that it will not fall down quietly. It will not walk away quietly and may try to ignite the whole region when it reaches a point of no return.
Likely by attacking Israel in one form or another.
Israel can also respond, so that that may deter them, but they can attack Jordan. They have missiles that can hit several countries in the region. Israel is not necessarily the sole or the preferred option, but it may be one of their choices.
We will talk much more with Itamar Rabinovich when we return on To Jewish in a few moments.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grand, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 30th to June 12th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. Of all things, an Israeli baseball note, three Jewish former major leaguers will try to help Israel field a competitive team in its bid to qualify for the World Baseball Classic. Sean Green, Brad Ausmus, and Gabe Kapler met last week in Los Angeles with Israeli baseball officials and promised to help out. It's unclear whether any of the three would actually play for Israel themselves, although Sean Green said he would help in any capacity. If I felt like that was a role the team needed, I would prepare for it, he said, adding that I feel a strong connection to Israel and it would be an honor to put on the uniform. Peter Kurtz, the Israel Association of Baseball's Secretary General, said that one of the three former players is likely to be the Israeli team's manager and that all of them will help with coaching, recruiting, and fundraising. Israel will be one of 16 countries invited to play in next year's qualifying round, the top four teams advancing to the 2013 World Baseball Classic. And another Jewish baseball story last week. For many decades, no Major League Baseball players wore batting gloves. But because of Irving Franklin, who passed away last week, almost all do today. Franklin didn't invent them. September 4th, 1964, Ken Harrelson of the Kansas City Athletics started the custom by wearing a golf glove to protect a blistered hand in a game against the Yankees. He hit two home runs, making batting gloves an instant attraction for ballplayers. But Irving Franklin, who died at 93 last week, was really the father of the modern batting glove. He teamed up with Mike Schmidt, the great Phillies third baseman, to design it and spread it through big league clubhouses and on to all levels of baseball. Made by Franklin Sports, the company that Irving Franklin and his brother Sidney started and led, the glove has been the official batting glove of Major League Baseball since the late 1980s. Miguel Cabrera, the Major League batting champion in 2011, and Jose Bautista, the home run leader, both used Franklin gloves. You know, batting gloves, like helmets, were a relatively late addition to the national pastime. Gloves are really not required still, but players pretty much all use them because they provide comfort, warmth, better grip, and shock absorption. Gives them a more secure feeling, especially early in the swing. Irving Franklin's son Larry remembers that his father was eager to get a top player to endorse something his company made, and so he signed up Mike Schmidt, now a Hall of Famer, who suggested batting gloves. They got together at spring training in 1983. Franklin contributed his knowledge of making sporting goods from leather. Mike Schmidt gave a player's view, continually criticizing and tweaking the designs. Schmidt personally approached his fellow All-Stars to try the gloves, and 30 signed up. More than 150 big league ballplayers now use the Schmidt design gloves, which have changed little from the original design. The average player goes through 8 dozen pairs of baseball gloves a year. Larry Franklin, who's now president of the company, said Major League Baseball called his dad in 1988, about 5 years after they got into the glove market, by which time Franklin Sports had 80% of it, and they asked him to come to New York. The baseball official suggested making the Franklin glove the official one, as they had previously given official status to Wilson's fielding glove, Rawlings baseball, and Louisville's slugger. Franklin Sports paid a fee for the designation. It has never lapsed. Players also get a little bit of money, in addition to lots of free gloves. Some stars, like Barry Bonds and Cal Ripken, were featured in ads and got even more money. In 1998, the year he broke Roger Maris's single-season home run record, Mark McGwire actually turned down $1 million to endorse all of Nike's products in order to stay with Franklin's gloves. Franklin was paying him $5,000 a year. Irving Franklin was born in 1918 in Massachusetts. He was employed first in a shoe factory, then followed his grandfather into the scrap leather business. He later took over the business. During the Korean War, he made things like trigger finger mittens for the military. They moved on to making footballs and other sports equipment, toys, sports medicine. But Irving Franklin was particularly pleased about his batting gloves because the name of his company was so easy to see whenever the television cameras closed in on a hitter. His other official Major League products, cups and athletic supporters, were not so easy to see on camera. Thank God. We welcome our expert on Israel, our maven Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We recently commemorated a sad anniversary, the 16th anniversary of the murder of Yitzhak Rabin, the great Prime Minister of Israel, Nobel Peace Prize winner. Does that still have great meaning in Israel?
Yes, I think it does. You know, Rabin was a very special person. He started his way as a military leader. The War of 48, the Independence War, he was responsible for all the route going to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Bringing
the
supplies.
The Bab el-Wad and, you know.
Exactly.
Right.
Which was very significant. Not many people aware today that the Jewish community in Jerusalem was actually under a blockade and did not have, you know, food and medicines. So his part on that was very significant. Later on, with time, he became chief of staff of the IDF.
Right before 1967.
Exactly.
Six-Day War.
And of course, after he left the army and went into politics, he became the leader of the Labor Party and became the prime minister. He actually was the prime minister twice.
Yeah.
Along his career.
I remember when I was there in the 70s, he was prime minister, and then he left. There was a minor scandal, and then he came back, really in a very different and very interesting role when he became kind of the statesman. That wasn't his initial, you know, he was just the Labor Prime Minister guy at first.
Right. And at the latest part of his life, he was leading a line that was, you could say, very favor of peace or of trying to create a compromise in order to achieve peace. I can't really say if he in person really believed Yasser Arafat or not. That's a question that many people ask me. Do you think Rabin really trusted Yasser Arafat?
I don't think so, personally.
I don't think so. Okay, yeah. I don't think he trusted him.
Yeah.
It was very clear from pictures that he had rough issues with even, you know, shaking hands with Yasser Arafat. I'm not even sure if there is a picture of them shaking hands, actually, when I'm trying to think of it. But I think the assassination was more significant, not only because it shifted or had a strong influence on the relationship with the Arabs and the Palestinians, but more than that, it was a shock because it was an attack on democracy. It was the first time in Israel history where a person decided to do an act that was against democracy. Many people in the Israeli society did not agree with Rabin's way. There were a lot of movements and a lot of demonstrations against. But I don't think that prior to the assassination, anyone even thought that such an assassination can take place in Israel. And I think this shock is still holding up today.
Yeah, fascinating. There's a new Rabin Center, which we'll visit on our temple trip to Israel in June. And, you know, his legacy is very interesting, very complex, and who knows, maybe it's not finished.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting, and the road for peace is still in front of us. There are ups, there are downs, but there is always hope.
God willing.
Yeah.
Thanks. We'll talk next week, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, best place downtown to get a meal any time of day.
We just celebrated our first year anniversary.
Mazel
tov. We're serving, thank you, lunch, dinner. Happy hour starts at 4 every day. We have late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights with live music. It really is. We are busy from the time we open the doors. It's so much fun to be downtown.
It's a great thing to go there and then go on and see a show, isn't it?
Yeah. Pre-performance, people are really get busy then. It's fantastic. Make your reservations. Come in and eat before the theater or the symphony or the opera. Then come back afterwards and have some dessert.
What's the best way to make reservation for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
Just get on the phone and give us a call, 623-7700, or go to our website, downtownkitchen.com.
You can also get there through the Janos website, I think, janos.com.
We make it easy to find us.
Thanks, Janos. See you for the holidays, Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about tolerance last week. Its absence in our world, its importance for our world. Let's talk about some of the specifics.
Well, there are many specifics. I mean, one of the questions is, what do you do to promote tolerance? It's not enough for rabbis and imams and priests and ministers to talk about it, because they've been doing that for 2,000 or 3,000 years, clearly without fully achieving the desired result.
Hold low, as Franz Rosenzweig said, not quite yet.
Right. And so, you know, one thing you can do is legislation. When you examine, for example, the history of the civil rights movement in the U.S., In the 60s, a lot of important bits of legislation were put into place. Well, you can't legislate feelings, but you can legislate behavior. And sometimes, and this is a good Hasidic principle, sometimes feelings follow behavior. If you act the just man, you become the just man. If you act the happy person, you become happy. If you act patiently, you become patient. So there's something to be said for the value of good legislation. There's also something to be said, I think, for the value of good education. Systems which try consciously to educate for tolerance.
There are some excellent programs, I know, for K through 12 schools teaching tolerance from the Anti-Defamation League. There's a number of other programs, Golden Rule programs. And many school districts really do integrate character education and tolerance.
Right.
But it's not by any means nationally established standard.
Certainly in this country, nothing's universal. And even in this state, nothing's universal.
That's a fact.
But there are countries which have done a really good job, not surprisingly, given its past. Germany. Germany, on a national level, has incredible programs at every level of its educational system to promote tolerance. And the one city in Germany that was always the most tolerant of every kind of dissident and bohemian and hippies, whatever, for like forever, was Berlin. And I was struck on my first visit to Berlin by how many large posters I saw on lampposts, street lamps, really like posters that were maybe 3 feet by 8 feet, asking the question in German, what does Berlin cuisine mean? And showing the answers of Vietnamese this, and Indonesian that, and Turkish this, and all of that was an intrinsic part of Berlin cuisine. And what they were clearly trying to do was promote tolerance for the many different ethnic minorities that now live in Berlin, including a resurgent Jewish community of great importance. Another country that recently did this, thanks in part to one of my U.S. diplomat friends and colleagues, Jonathan Katz, who deserves full credit for this. He was posted in Sweden. His wife is a Swedish national. And he was disturbed by a newspaper account that very few Swedish school children knew anything about the Holocaust. So he took it up with the Ministry of Education there. And they started first a program of Holocaust education, but then they expanded that into a program of education for tolerance. In other words, conditioning kids to become more tolerant based on the results of past examples of intolerance. So sometimes not just legislation, but education or a little bit of knowledge can go a long way towards like tempering our evil impulses.
You know, I also think that tolerance and tolerance education is extremely important. Jews are a tiny minority around the world. It's an advantage to us, certainly, any place where there's increased tolerance. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Friends and family were at the Jewish cemetery for Moshe's funeral. Just before the service commenced, the rabbi went over to Ruth, an elderly widow, and said, "How old was Moshe?" "He was 99, kinahara," replies Ruth, "2 years older than me." "So you must be 97, says the rabbi. And Ruth replies, "Yes, hardly worth going back home, is it?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and go home. This week's Torah portion of Toldot includes the treachery of Jacob and the foolishness of Esau, the famous story of brotherly rivalry that sets in motion this central tale in Genesis. It's a story of fraternal twins who are anything but fraternal in their interactions. Jacob, we are told, is a lover of tents, a homebody, whose mother loves him. Esau is a hunter, an outdoorsman, a man active in the extreme, and more or less devoid of thought, loved by his dad. In our weekly portion, Jacob fools his family twice. First, on his own, he cons the hungry Esau into selling his birthright, his inheritance, for a bowl of porridge. Then, at the instigation of his mother Rebekah, Jacob fools his father Isaac into giving him the principal blessing, the spiritual heritage of the leadership of the people who will someday be known as Israel. Why is it that Jacob is the one who will become the true father of our people? He is clever and cerebral, verbal, but he clearly lacks basic moral qualities that we should find critical. But Esau, too, is no bargain. Athletic and strong, he is all physical exertion and emotional outburst, instinctive but unreflective, id to Jacob's superego. Neither brother is a bargain. Neither is a complete good human being. One, Jacob, demonstrates the excesses of intellectual egotism and manipulation. The other, Esau, shows the danger of acting purely from instinct and emotion. In fact, it's through both of them that the great story of God's oneness is carried forward. The message here is complex, but useful. The truth is that we are all both Jacob and Esau, partly thoughtful, partly instinctive. Each of us are also twins in this sense. We can act with deliberation and care, or forcefully and without judgment. And we all have the capacity to be either ethical or unethical. In that dichotomy lies our innate humanity. And in the persons of Esau and Jacob, we can see ourselves, the balance we need to seek between these halves, and learn that it's only through God's providence we can truly find wholeness and our own promised land. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest Itamar Rabinovich, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, will explain exactly what's going to happen in the future throughout the Middle East, or not. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Bethel's Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a TV special hosted by Diane Sawyer last week, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, a friend and frequent guest of Two Jewish, spoke publicly for the first time since the terrible shooting on January 8th. There were several photos of her wedding under the chuppah to astronaut Mark Kelly and the encouraging news that she has made dramatic improvement, hard won, over the past 10 months. While it's not clear just how far her recovery will ultimately take her, the extraordinary footage showing her early stages of recovery through today demonstrated phenomenal hard work and tremendous tenacity. Our prayers continue to go out to Gabby as she works towards a refuah shlema, a full recovery. It was heartening to see her vibrant and, to a degree, verbal again. Also last week, Gabby Giffords was named to the top spot on the Forward 50 list of the most prominent Jews in America. That is quite an honor. On the other hand, in addition to such former Two Jewish luminaries as Ruth Messenger, Rabbi Jill Jacobs, Bill Kristol, and Eric Cantor, there was also Anthony Weiner and Fred Wilpon on the list. Still an honor, but maybe not an unmitigated one. In New York, two Muslim businessmen have saved the oldest bagel bakery in the city. New York City's Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels closed in September because of the bad economy, but Pirzada Shah and Zafaria Ali rescued the 91-year-old shop from shutting down permanently. Morris Rosenzweig, a Jewish immigrant from Bialystok, Poland, founded the shop back in 1920. Ali and Shah said that the first Bialy's and Bagels they ever tried were made at Coney Island. Ali once worked at the shop as a baker and contacted his former roommate, Shah, when he heard it was closing. They decided to invest in the landmark and not only keep it open, but continue to use the same recipes using the shop's kosher-certified equipment. They also intend to continue serving the existing kosher menu. "I felt I had to save this store," said Ali. "I'm happy I can take care of it, turn a profit, and make customers happy." Ali and Shah explained that the divide between Muslims and Jews has no bearing on making bagels and bialys. "Doesn't matter," Ali said. "I make the food for everybody. I don't even think about it," added Shah. "I just look at this as a business opportunity." Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels' former owner, Stephen Ross, who is of course Jewish, couldn't be happier about the Pakistani-born businessman's decision to purchase the place. Ross has been advising them and wishes them the very best. "I hope they build the business up and do more business than I did," he said. Last year, the dramatic fact that an Orthodox woman, Sara Hurwitz, was ordained as an Orthodox rabbi was the big news story. And now, for the first time ever in the United States, an Orthodox rabbi has officiated at a same-sex wedding. Rabbi Steve Greenberg, a former guest of Two Jewish who is openly gay, married Yoni Bach and Ron Kaplan at the 6th and I Historic Synagogue in Washington, D.C. last week. Steve Greenberg has Orthodox smicha from Yeshiva University's Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary, perhaps the most important modern Orthodox seminary in the United States. The ceremony was held under a chuppah and included the breaking of a glass and the exchanging of rings. The ketubah, or marriage contract, was replaced with a shtar shtufim, a partnership contract. "We were encouraged by the legislation of same-sex marriage in our home state of Washington, D.C., Bach and Kaplan wrote in their guide to the ceremony. "At the same time, both of us wanted a ceremony that would be meaningful halachically, that is in Jewish law, and create a set of Jewish legal obligations between us. It is believed to be the first time that an ordained Orthodox rabbi has ever officiated a same-sex marriage in the United States. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our distinguished guest, Professor Itamar Rabinovich. He's a Yerushalmi, originally from Jerusalem, born there in 1942. He holds the Ettinger Chair of Contemporary Middle Eastern History at Tel Aviv University, has served as the university's president for 8 years, a member of the Tel Aviv University faculty since 1971. He's the former ambassador to the United States on behalf of Israel and has served a wide variety of roles, both academic and professional, authored a number of books and many, many articles, and sits on, I don't know, about 15 or 20 important boards, some of them as chairman. Professor Rabinovich, in looking at the changes in the region, as we did earlier in the show, we talked about Syria. If Syria, as you say, the regime is doomed, Syria has been a principal sponsor of Hamas and Hezbollah both. What does that do to their status, and how does that change things in places like Lebanon, which Syria is also controlled?
Both Hamas and Hezbollah feel weakened by the crisis in Syria. I think that one of the reasons that made the Gilad Shalit exchange feasible was that sense of weakness by Hamas. They moderated some of their demands. Hezbollah lies low, but Syria is not the sole sponsor of Hezbollah and Hamas. Iran is a more remote but hardly less significant supporter. In fact, I would say that Hezbollah in Lebanon is an arm of the Iranian regime. So even if there is a change of regime in Syria, and even if Hezbollah and Hamas are weakened, they will not remain without external support or sponsorship.
So chances are, while it weakens them some, it's not going to be of tremendous existential threat to their ability to continue.
That is correct. Weakening, but not elimination.
Turkey had been a increasingly close ally of Israel in the last, since the Mavi Marmar incident, but really before then and certainly subsequent to that. That's no longer the case. Talk about what the long-term prospects are, in your view, for Israel's relationship with Turkey.
Long-term, I don't know. Intermediate term, not good. Because Turkey has been taken over by an Islamist government that is transforming the country. It's now ruled by a different ruling elite, the secular westward-looking elite of the Turkish Republic is being replaced by people who come from the provinces, are more conservative, more Islamist. Turkey has been rebuffed by Europe. It looks more to the east. It is looking for influence and prestige in its own environment, that is to say, could be the Caucasus, Central Asia, but primarily the Middle East. Turkey is a very powerful actor. It's a country of more than 80 million with a very large military. It's a member of NATO. It's an economic power. It has the 15th economy in the world. And it's been very unfortunate for us that from a very close friend, it's become an adversary, not quite an enemy, but definitely an adversary. There's also a personal dimension here because the leader of Turkey, Prime Minister Erdogan, is a man with a clear sense of his own importance and very whimsical. And I have to add this when I mentioned before that there are certain negative trends from our point of view in the region. The change in Turkey and Turkish-Israeli relations is definitely one of them.
When Israel next enters into some kind of negotiations with the Palestinians, because somehow there's always another set of negotiations, even if the current ones don't happen, do you think Israel is in a stronger or weaker position since the declaration of the Palestinian state with the changes in the region in general?
Israel is in a weaker position because the rules of the game have changed to some extent. The Palestinians discovered that they can play in more than one arena. So if the negotiations with Israel were the principal arena, almost the exclusive arena until very recently, they discovered that they can obtain a great deal of international support, We saw the vote in the UN General Assembly. We saw the vote that admitted them as members of UNESCO. And therefore, they feel empowered. They feel that they have to make less concessions to Israel. They may even evade the whole arena of negotiations. It's very difficult for us to deal with this swelling support for the Palestinian cause around the world, coupled with the decline of support for Israel and decline of acceptance of Israel's legitimacy. Suddenly the word Zionist has become a dirty word. And therefore, we have a weaker hand in our dealings with the Palestinians.
You spent several years in Washington. You know the United States well. United States support for Israel has been extremely strong now for a long time. Some question about whether President Obama is quite as supportive, but it does really not seem to be changing the American level of support in so many ways. What do you see developing on that front in terms of the generational split between younger and older American Jews, between the strong positive support for Israel and some of the things that are happening on campus and in other parts of the United States public sphere?
I think that on the whole, support for Israel remains very strong, and not just in the Jewish community, but in Christian communities and the military establishment. I would say that our defense relationship with the United States have never been closer, even at the time of diplomatic tension between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government. The security cooperation has been very good. We share many interests. The Arab Spring that we mentioned before emphasizes Israel's importance as an ally to the United States because it is stable and loyal, while others are shifting, and these changes create an uncertainty. At the same time, among certain groups in the academy, there is a greater criticism of Israel. And, of course, in the Jewish community, the trend that previous generation, current generation of older or more mature people who remember the Holocaust, the birth of Israel, the Six-Day War, and other formative events, been replaced by younger members who are not, I would say, automatically as supportive. We find out that when an investment is made, and I would mention, for instance, the Birthright Project, that brings many thousands of young Jews to Israel, and they all return very enthused. So that means that things must not be taken for granted, and massive investment needs to be made in Jewish education and in fostering the relationship of younger Jews to the state of Israel. Think not just of Birthright, but other programs, study abroad in Israel, internships, using, you know, today communication or telecommunication is much easier than it used to be. The internet should be put into service of linking classrooms to classrooms. We have to be inventive and creative in thinking about fostering this relationship.
So a totally different question. Israel is an informal country. When you're in America and you were the ambassador, everybody called you Mr. Ambassador. What do they call you when you get back home?
It varies. Most people here call you by your first name. Right. So, and that's fine. That's I think part of the charm of Israel is the informality.
What do you think Israel's best choices would be now in terms of strengthening the relationship, not so much with America or the American government, but with younger American Jews, besides the Birthright Program? What can Israel itself do?
Israel must send a message to young Jews that there's an added value in having an Israel experience or an Israel relationship. That today, of course, we live in a globalized world, and young people around the world share many aspects of popular culture, but Israel still has its distinctive culture. Tel Aviv is a wonderful place of very effervescent cultural and artistic life. Jerusalem is a unique place in the world. So our challenge is to explain to young American Jews in their own language and in the terminology and conceptual framework that speaks to them, that you want this nexus to Israel not just because the older generations had it, but because it has its own value. And that challenge is definitely, as you say, up to us.
I want to thank Itamar Rabinovich for a terrific visit here on Too Jewish. What's the best way that people can find out more about your work and your books?
Just Google me.
Like everybody today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish. Toda rabba lecha.
Thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470. On Sunday afternoon, November 20th, 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, the beautiful sacred service by Swiss-American composer Ernest Bloch will be performed by the Tucson Masterworks Chorale. This fantastic piece of music was originally commissioned by San Francisco's Temple Emmanuel, and it's one of the 20th century's finest classical works. Bloch described this passionate and romantic setting of text for the Jewish Saturday morning service as a cosmic poem, a glorification of the laws of the universe. For the Bloch Sacred Service, the Masterworks Chorale is conducted by Marcella Molina and will feature Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan as the baritone soloist. Don't miss this extraordinary performance Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson. For tickets or more information, call the Tucson Masterworks Chorale at 730-5640 or Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Howard Megdahl, author of The Baseball Talmud. And of course, please listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website where you can stream us and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli great David Broza, a former guest of Too Jewish. It's called Srochim, Laces. I try to wonder a lot, but I get my laces caught. Every stray little dog was my new best friend, and if I had to do it all over again, I'd do it again with you. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
בגיל 30 החיים קשים ונפשי עוד כמה אל הרגע הרך ואם היה עליי לעשות זאת שוב הייתי עושה זאת שוב איתך כוכבי האהוב כה זוהר ועצוב ויפה כמו חלום צבעוני ומסובך אם היה עליי לגלות זאת שוב הייתי מגלה זאת שוב איתך הילדים ישנים ואת לא חשוב אני כותב את שיריי במטבח אם היה עליי לכתוב זאת שוב הייתי כותב זאת שוב